Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. Especially after everything that happened, the insanity of Martin Luther King Day, I had an idea of who I wanted to talk with. Sirith Sohi is a very talented writer and somebody who has a good perspective on especially those sorts of things, but we only start there. We go in a lot of different places. She writes the tip-off for SB Nation. She covers the Raptors for The Athletic and writes all over the place, especially when she does her features, which I'm such a huge fan of. And so we do start with the Rockets and Clippers and all that, but then we get into a lot of other topics. What teams are contenders now and in the future, what we're watching for the rest of the season, some of the development of young guys around the league, and of course the Raptors, a team that she follows very closely. So we go through all that. Conversation runs a little bit over an hour, and this episode is brought to you by Simple Contacts. Simple Contacts is a new sponsor of Real Jam Radio, a great way to get your vision tested less than 5 minutes. You can do it on your phone or on a computer, and then you can also order your contacts through them. And you can either use the URL, the promo code, simplecontacts.com/realgm, or the promo code realgm for $30 off your order. Again, this is a little bit over an hour. It's a fun conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. How's it going?
It's good. I feel like even though it is largely off the court, the place that we have to start is just the insanity in Staples Center on Martin Luther King Day. I mean, beyond being the fodder for one of the better Twitter nights in the history of NBA Twitter, it's an interesting story just because of all the complex interpersonal stuff going on between these two teams, where you have lots of players that have experience with the other team and that, you know, the Rockets going through the emotions of losing a game they wanted to win.
Yeah, I think, I'm sure that somebody's done this. There's a lot of great reporters in LA, but somebody's got to ask Doc and Blake how they feel about, you know, their previous insistence that things between Chris Paul and Blake Griffin were never really that bad and it was all overblown, because that did not look overblown at all.
It didn't. And also all the stuff between Chris Paul and Austin Rivers doesn't appear to have been overblown either. And what always rang true to me about the Austin Rivers element of this is that it made sense to me that he would rub people the wrong way, because it's a lot of the kind of elements that players just don't like. I mean, the NBA is thought of as a hard meritocracy. And while Rivers underperformed relative to his talent level in New Orleans, he got to the Clippers, got a big opportunity pretty quickly, got a bunch of money really quickly, and then is the coach's son. And so if they felt that, and so even if it was totally on the up and up, you would get that perception of the people in the room, like especially if you're sacrificing something, and then anything below the up and up would just be infuriating. And when you think about Chris Paul, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, on some level, there's always going to be sacrifice in that situation, because if he's playing, that means somebody else isn't, and that I think fairly should piss people off, because like you said, Rivers wasn't very good when he first came, and I know some of it's not even that. Some of it's very transparent, like the amount of weird speculation that's come out of LA about trades that haven't gone down because Rivers was involved, and I don't know, it's a weird situation. It always has been, and like I said before, you can't really blame anybody for being mad about it. And then on top of it, it's kind of like, look, like, you're kind of already, as much as he has improved, like, he's still kind of the butt of a lot of jokes. Perhaps if you're in a suit, just simmer down and sit on the bench. Like, you don't have to get involved in all this extra stuff when you're already Austin Rivers.
That's a good point. And also, in some ways, why the Blake Griffin element of this is more interesting is because that had been more rumored, that was below the surface. And Chris Paul talking about Lou Williams being their go-to scorer, you know, Chris Paul knows how that was going to be interpreted. He, as somebody who has dealt with media interpretations of his statements for a long time, especially in the LA market. So he knew where that was going to go. He said it deliberately. And you also think back to the kind of the near misses with this team. I mean, DeAndre Jordan came about as close to leaving as anybody ever has of their own volition. And there was, I watched Paul Pierce on The Jump on Tuesday, and he was trying not to speak too much out of school, but talked about the idea of that team was more individuals than a collective unit. It kind of seemed to me like that was more off the court than anything else. And all of that fits together for a team that just a lot of their playoff stuff was bad luck, you know, guys getting hurt at the wrong time. But it never did seem like they meshed in that way for a couple of justifiable reasons and the aforementioned bad luck.
Right. I mean, I don't think we should go back and ascribe chemistry issues to all their problems. First of all, I mean, even if they were healthy, they were going up against a Warriors juggernaut. And as much as there have been times when they've matched up okay with them, the Warriors pretty much ever since Kerr got there smacked them in the regular season, healthy or not. So I can't imagine a playoff matchup really going too differently for them, even if they were healthy. I mean, you never know what's going to happen, but at the same time, we don't really need to go back and re-legislate the Clippers' legacy. I think they kind of were what they were. They were a team that was, if the Warriors hadn't come along, maybe could have done something, but after that, they were just like every other team, every other contender in the league, rather, that they were kind of just trying to catch up. And, you know, chemistry issues obviously played a part in that. They always will, but that wasn't like the thing separating them from greatness or anything like that. And also, just now that you, I just remember now that you mentioned the jump, just to go back to the Austin Rivers thing, Paul Pierce was saying that there was a time when the Clippers were playing the Mavericks and Dirk Nowitzki went up to Pierce and was like, who the hell does Austin Rivers think he is? And Paul's reaction was basically like, man, if you've got Dirk mad at you, a lot of guys get upset, but if Dirk's mad at you, there's something going on.
And Rivers has been that guy for a long time. Swagger was probably a part of what got him to this point. I mean, you have to be talented and believe in yourself really to get to it, but there is a threshold to it. And also, it's a lot more tolerable in certain circumstances. Not saying they're the same type of guy with Chris Paul, as good as he is, versus Austin Rivers, who's more of a sport player. And Austin Rivers is probably in the top 1% of basketball players in the world. But that is different in the NBA, where it's like the top 5%, 10% of that can really do some of the stuff that he pulls off. And one thing that I've been thinking about in the scope of the Clippers, and this week has been crystallizing for this, is how sort of appropriate it is that their best success and their biggest failure were in the same postseason. And that was when they beat the Spurs in a wonderful series. Chris Paul has that huge shot in Game 7, and then they blow the series to the Rockets. And really, that's kind of both sides of the Clipper coin, where you got to see what they could be and then why they could never be everything.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And there's even some idea of like Clippers juju going on in there too, right? Like with Josh Smith hitting all those shots, or, you know, you're making the right play by making Josh Smith take all the shots as opposed to anybody else on Houston. I think, you know, you'd rather have him shooting than Harden or Ariza or like go down low. So, you know, that was the right play. But then all of a sudden, this guy who, like, Hawks fans used to audibly, you know, groan when he was about to pull up for a shot, he starts going off, and, you know, they just can't miss, and it seems like there's nothing the Clippers can do. And you really, and on top of that, there was Chris Paul's injury, which, I mean, as much as I think what happened that series, they went Clippers went up 2-0, right, in the start, or did they win? Or did they win Game 1 and then decide they were going to rest Chris Paul because in their eyes they were playing with house money since they won a game against the Rockets? Chris Paul was dealing with some injuries as well, so there was a lot going against them. But yeah, you're totally right in that they kind of showed everything they can be by beating the Spurs. It was, you know, Blake was playing out of his mind, probably the best seven game stretch, or the most impressive 7-game stretch that we've ever seen him play. And then, you know, at the end you've got Chris Paul also like just doing it in the clutch too. And one of the underrated parts about that series is actually they had an opportunity to really like Clipper that whole thing when DeAndre goaltended a go-ahead shot by Chris Paul, but they ended up pulling that game out. And, you know, that's one of the sneaky forgotten moments in NBA history. And it really, really could have been bad for him. And it really, I mean, it could have defined what we think of DeAndre Jordan, but it turns out it did it. And, but yeah, like, I mean, you're totally right. That was, we really got the full range of Clipper experience. And like, I think, what was it? 13 games.
Yeah. It was a wild run. And I had totally forgotten about that DeAndre play. You're right about that. And you were also right about the way that it went in that series. The Clippers won Game 1 pretty comfortably, and then they sat CP in Game 2 and lost it. And then they further vindicated it by, you know, by winning games 3 and 4. Like, that was another, that was a series where they had a 3-1 lead, but why that wasn't as big a deal then is A, it wasn't the conference finals, it was the second round, and B, because game 5 was the Rockets winning at home. So it's not like that was any big deal. And so then the way the collapse happened, and because the memes hadn't happened yet, because this was 2015, not 2016, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, the Clippers, they always had that ability that to be more than the sum of their parts. If they had gone to the defensive approach that they used a lot of last year and stayed healthy, I think they could have been even better. And now, you know, what the other part of it that gets complicated is how the Clippers decided not to blow it up. Their reaction to Chris Paul saying, not only am I going to leave, but I'm going to leave to go to a team in the conference, and I'm going to facilitate it by opting in, which actually really helped the Clippers and might be part of the reason they did that. And so the Clippers, they got Beverly, Sam Decker, Montrezl Harrell was having a wonderful year in that trade. And then they're working from all those pieces, and Lou Williams was in that trade too, and he's been huge for them. But they decided to kind of keep everything together and then add Gallinari, who basically hasn't been healthy. So this isn't Clippers at the peak of their powers versus the Rockets at the peak of their powers, but that kind of leads to it being in a different place than it would have been if the Clippers had been rebuilding or something else.
Yeah, I think when you look back at their free agency, I mean, I know the easy thing always seems to be to tear something down, but not necessarily easy, but as far as steps go. But when you really think about it, like, the Clippers, so long as they could keep Griffin, the steps to them kind of finding this place where they're competitive but they're not going to contend for anything was actually a lot easier after the Chris Paul trade, because then it was facilitated for them to be able to kind of pick it up and believe that they could do it, because got Griffin and Jordan, two very, very high level players. You've seen enough of Griffin that you can put faith in him to be the number one guy on your team. And, you know, I've always thought that the offense should have been run through him when Chris Paul was on the Clippers too. And I think they would have had a lot more success, especially in the playoffs. If they had done that, it would have just given them a lot more diversity. And I think we saw some of that in the early regular season. But, you know, back to my point, if you know that you can get Milos and then you can get Gallinari, you can kind of build around that, and it's less steps and less complications. And it was kind of like an irresistible scenario for them to just keep the train chugging along, as opposed to, first of all, letting Griffin walk for nothing would kind of suck. Even if you do get something, if you did get something back for Paul, it's just kind of, that's a tough thing to swallow when you have the opportunity to keep him. And on the other end, you know, like, we're seeing it now, what's the trade market for DeAndre Jordan? And it would have been worse if they had been tearing things down, because his, like, the Clippers would have never not had any leverage. At least right now they have some leverage. They can say, hey, you know what, if we don't get a good enough offer, keep the train moving and see if we can make the playoffs. So the path to rebuilding was just so much more complicated for them, I think, than retooling. And of course, you've got the new arena and everything. So, you know, it's easy to see why they went down the road that they did.
And the point you got to at the end is so important here, is that it led them towards a path that was the path they wanted to go anyway. Because Steve Ballmer, you know, they don't want to be the other tenant in Staples Center. That is the Lakers building for all intents and purposes. And they wanted that. And you being a competitive team markedly helps. I mean, California is not the most amenable to arenas and all that kind of stuff. There are a lot of reasons why. And so the Clippers thought that would be a more reasonable case to make. I think it was. It's just that they chose to prioritize it. And the upside of that is, to a degree, they were right. I mean, this Clippers team, if they were even a little bit healthier than they have been so far, they would be more clearly in the playoff picture. And the West, one of the gambits that they kind of made in that was, yeah, they're probably not going to be a competitor to win the West or to win the championship, was that it looks like the West playoff picture is a little bit lighter than it was going to be before. That doesn't necessarily mean the Clippers are, I don't think they're going to jump up to like the 5 seed or anything, but Memphis not being what some people thought they were going to be, Dallas due to Seth Curry still being out, the Blazers haven't really inspired this year, and then, you know, with New Orleans, we still have to see if they're going to be healthy. So the Clippers have gotten themselves in that mix, partially because Lou Williams has been unbelievable when they were without their injuries. And so in a way, like, the prediction that Ballmer and Lawrence Frank and Doc made was right, even though it didn't look, that decision looked more accurate 2 months ago, 3 months ago than it did a couple weeks ago when it looked like the wheels were falling off.
Well, we still got some time before things are set. And this, I think the trap they fell into is if healthy. Like, if healthy, this team has a mid-level ceiling, at least playoff-wise. But, I mean, that's with this team, that's such a big if. And there's still so many games to go. And it's still, I mean, it's pretty tight. Right now, they're ninth. And they can get in there. But doesn't seem like Denver's going away. So, I mean, it'll kind of be between, like, those four teams. But, I don't know. It can still fall apart with any injury with them, especially if something happens to Blake again. Or, I mean, you know, maybe Lou Williams can carry them, but you know, there's still a lot of games to be played. So I'm not really comfortable saying that they made the right call yet.
Yeah, I still think if they had moved quickly and gotten down towards the bottom, I actually think they also could have done that by including some of the players that they acquired in the Chris Paul trade and future trades, that they could have gotten the asset base to be better really quickly, because one of the unusual elements with the Clippers is that they do owe picks in the future, but those picks are really heavily protected. So if they had pivoted and just been bad for probably this year and next year, I think they could have gotten to the point where they could have been really good. They could have cleaned their books next summer. I don't know who would have necessarily been interested. They also could have theoretically been in the mix for Paul George, especially if they said, hey, we're going to be able to bring in another max guy next summer. I think that major markets should consider doing that more often, especially even secondary teams in major markets. I mean, I've argued for it for the Knicks and the Lakers forever, but the Nets and the Clippers at a certain point too, because they could rely on bad management for those other franchises. So we'll see where it goes from here.
I wanted to add, I totally agree with you when it comes to thinking that major markets should be making those moves more often. That's actually something I wrote about right before the Clippers signed Milos. Running it back kind of showed to me that they didn't have enough confidence in what they'd built as like their franchise's brand, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, over the Ballmer era. Because if you had that level of faith, you probably would have done things differently. But I think they kind of just felt like they didn't have the cachet to rebuild yet without completely becoming irrelevant. And I don't think that's true. I think, you know, first of all, they've done a lot of work in the Griffin era to get rid of that perception. And the owner that created that perception is gone too. And, you know, it seems like they pumped a lot of money into just player development things and, you know, their facilities. And it seems to be, I've never been there, but actually I have been there, but it's been years. But it seems like very like tech savvy, and you are in LA, you know, maybe there are players who don't necessarily want to play with the Lakers, who are a little bit turned off by the whole LeVar thing. I don't know if that's a thing that really affects too many players, but there's always the chance that, you know, when you're looking at it, maybe you even keep Griffin in this instance, but don't necessarily make all these other contract offers. And maybe somebody's saying, hey, you know what? Blake Griffin is a pretty good guy to have as your second guy. And there's no drama and kind of fly under the radar, but still live like a pretty great LA lifestyle. And, you know, the infrastructure was in place for them to do that. I think they said it, and, you know, it was kind of disappointing to me to not see them go that way.
Me too. And they have a lot of that also with the idea that the Lakers were so and have been so gung-ho about 2018. I really want to see if I just published a piece for the Sporting News about how they can get two max slots. But I want to see what the Lakers do if they don't get the right guys this year. Will they wait? Is the new management with Pelinka, Magic, and now the Genie has so much control, are they patient enough? Because we don't know who's going to be available in 2019 either. It might be Clay, might be Kawhi, who knows? Like, it's a little bit too early for that, but I don't think Kawhi's going to be available. That's my instinct. A guy that is forgotten, as he's on the LA fringes. This has been an argument before. He's from Riverside. I consider that like an LA area kid, but it's anyway. And so if let's say the Lakers were impatient, which is a good bet to make because that's just their franchise history, then the Clippers could have really been in the right spot. They could have done that. And who knows, maybe Paul George would rather be with the Clippers, the team he actually grew up rooting for. He didn't grow up a Lakers fan. And that would have been a possibility. So I think they kind of sold, as you said, they sold themselves short. And it's not the biggest thing, because it would have been hard for them to really retool and become like a championship level team anyway or something like that. But all of those things matter. Want to take a quick moment to tell you about a new sponsor for Real Jam Radio, and one that I'm really excited about, Simple Contacts. And Simple Contacts is a great idea at solving a problem that many of us have to deal with. I do it in a different way because I wear glasses, but those of us who have vision issues and who need corrective things have to deal with vision tests, and vision tests are often cumbersome. They take time. You have to schedule it, and hopefully it works. I actually had to deal with this recently when I got new glasses, that I had to go through a whole thing because it was under a time constraint. It became a whole to-do, and simple contacts would have been an amazing solution to that, because you can get a 5-minute vision test from your phone or your computer. It is reviewed by a licensed doctor, and then you can receive a renewed 1-year prescription and reorder your contacts. So it is a less than 5-minute test. It gets reviewed by licensed ophthalmologists. The test was designed by doctors. And so then you take that idea, which is something that I identify with personally, and then you combine that with the choice of all of the contact lens brands that you're familiar with, and the support with, they're going for 100% satisfaction, and cost. The vision test is only $20, and that can be a lot more expensive. I mean, can be in the hundreds easily, depending on whether you have vision insurance or not, and a lot of us, including myself, do not. And their contact lens prices are fantastic, and standard shipping is free. And on top of all that, you can, and I love this, that is either a URL or a promo code. So you can either go to simplecontacts.com/RealGM, or you can enter the RealGM promo code, and you get $30 off your first order, which is fantastic. So again, that is simplecontacts.com/RealGM or RealGM, whichever one makes you happy. And you can try it out. That also tells them you came from us. Hopefully they will keep advertising for us. And vision test, you can reorder your contacts. It's a pretty fantastic service to have it all in one place. And also, we want to make sure to note that it is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but you can still get your vision checked and everything else. It's absolutely fantastic. So check it out, simplecontacts.com/RealGM, or just the RealGM promo code for $30 off your first order. The other thing I wanted to talk with you about, which I just find so fascinating about this year, we're past the halfway point now. The Warriors are the Warriors. We haven't even really seen them too much at full strength, but a lot of the other teams that are in the discussion for potentially winning a championship, we haven't really seen them at full strength, or we haven't seen it for very long. The Rockets, CP missed a bunch of time. Harden just is coming back from this hamstring injury. Isaiah's been out. Cleveland has been going through all this stuff. The Celtics aren't going to have Gordon Hayward probably back this season. And so in some ways, that's a bad thing just because you're building up the excitement. But in some ways, it's a good thing because we're going to see these teams round into form, assuming they can get healthy as opposed to stay healthy. We'll be able to see that, and they'll be kind of rising as the playoffs get here.
Yeah, it kind of I feel like it kind of gives something to look forward to. I was going to say that it kind of puts a damper on this part of the season, but we actually had like the best form of entertainment happen 2 nights ago. So I can't necessarily say that, but it's interesting because it makes you think a lot about team building, and some of it is injuries. But when you look at things that are what's going on in Cleveland, it really makes you think about, hey, like it's more than just like putting a bunch of people together. And even in Houston, it's not like how quick was everybody to believe that James Harden and Chris Paul got into a fight, you know? Like, it really makes you appreciate the Warriors and that they've been so dominant over this stretch, because I mean, they haven't been healthy, and obviously, like, even when they aren't healthy, they're still far more talented than pretty much any other team in the league. But you know, they've got this built-in continuity that I don't think any of the other contenders in the league really have, because of how much retooling there's been all season. I feel like we've kind of been waiting. I mean, we waited all off season to see how all these changes would affect the league, and we're still kind of just laying in wait here. And I think like the one team that's probably handled it the best is Boston. And you know, granted, they had from day one of the season to deal with it, whereas everybody else has kind of dealt with like nagging stuff, and this guy's out, now this guy's out. So it's a bit of a different scenario. But you know, I still feel like everybody that isn't the Warriors or the Celtics is kind of just like this amorphous thing that I have to wait and see what's going on. And I think a lot of people feel the same way.
It also combines with the earlier trade deadline and just the structure of these teams, that I don't think we're going to see much movement for the franchises at the top at the deadline, kind of in this stretch, because A, they don't want to, you know, they don't want to give up a ton of assets if it's not going to make you meaningfully better, really up your chances of winning the championship. Because like, as great as Boston's season has been, even the most optimistic Celtics person would say their chances of winning a championship are better next year or 2 years from now than they are right now. And so, like, why give up assets to change that? Also, it'd be hard for them to do it. And with Cleveland, it's a lot more complicated because of that Nets pick and LeBron being noncommittal. And LeBron has earned the right to be noncommittal, but he has also, by virtue of that, not earned the right to complain if Cleveland doesn't use that asset to get better this year, because they have to play two games at the same time. And I understand that. And so I think we're going to see a largely stable situation there, but we're still going to be learning what these teams have. And then something else that I'm going to be really excited by for the rest of this year. So you have all those teams, and that's going to be, you know, worth watching, is the next group below and who shows that they have maybe not the ceiling to make a big dent this year, but when you're watching them going, oh, they're going to be coming. And so you could think of teams like the Bucks, now that Bledsoe is more fully integrated on this team. The Sixers, depending on how healthy, though, they're going to be missing Redick for a few weeks, and that's a concern. The Wolves have been playing fabulous basketball the last few weeks. OKC can come on. And so who of those kind of teams says, not only are we interesting this year, but next year, the year after that, you need to be thinking about us? And there are going to be a couple, but I don't know who it's going to be.
I mean, I think the Wolves have really cemented themselves as that team. Everybody else is kind of still floating around potential, I think. But, I mean, Minnesota's a 4 seed right now. They've got tons of upside. Towns is seemingly, it seems like he's just getting better, especially defensively, like pretty much every game at this rate. So they're really the team that sticks out to me in that they're kind of scary now, but they're going to be really, really scary in the future. And, you know, everyone else, kind of like, they're fun stories. I love watching Philadelphia play. Ben Simmons has probably been one of my favorite players to watch this season. But, you know, there's still so much to figure out, and there's the whole fault situation. It doesn't really give you too much faith in their front office, or at least you kind of have to have some pause there when you look at what's going on. And you know, and what was the other team you said? The Bucks. Like that's another situation where you don't really know what we don't know. First of all, the coaching situation could very well change. I think they need a lot more shooting around Giannis. They definitely have to make some changes. So they're not really a team that I think is like anywhere close to its final form. Not to say that Minnesota is. I think, you know, they could definitely use some offensive refinement, even as like they are slowly starting to figure out the defense out, and they are young, and they had a lot of turnover with their starters. So that was to be expected, but you know, they're probably the closest to looking the way that they should look for the next 5 years.
I would agree with that. And another team that is, I would say, probably below this, at least for right now, that hopefully they get better sooner is the Nuggets. And so the Nuggets, what makes them different is they've been without Paul Millsap for all this time. He got his cast removed recently, but I haven't heard anything that the projections last I heard was that it would be after the All-Star break. So that's still a ways from right now. And what's going to be interesting with them is, so at the beginning of the year, Millsap had some nice defensive moments, but their offense was really disjointed. And whether it was because of that or, you know, there's all these things being together, Jamal Murray was rough at the very beginning of this year. He's really come on and done a really nice job over the last little while. So if they can piece all this together, if Millsap can become a smaller cog in the offense machine, but then still be good defensively, they could be a team that other Western Conference, like the top half, doesn't want to play. But it's probably not going to be the year that they are more than that. So I want to see where they fit in with all this. And now with the news that came out today that we don't know how long Kawhi is going to be out, but basically that it's, you know, it's extending is really not great. But that's more of a long-term play. And so I want to see what the Nuggets are. And of course, I want to see the Spurs at full strength whenever the heck that happens.
Yeah, I love watching the Nuggets play. Like they're on the top of my random league pass, like not too much going on type of night. Like it's always going to, like, just watching Jokic operate and the way that he's even changed his game up a little bit this as the season has gone on. I know he's resisted being a scorer, but, you know, just little moments where he's actually not always looking to pass out of the soft doubles and whatnot. Like it's really fun to watch him grow. And then obviously when he's passing the ball, it's just fantastic. Like I was watching them play last night and he got an offensive rebound and like passed through people's shoulders to get a three for Harris. And like, you know, it's just stuff that you don't even expect. And like, you can tell like defenses don't expect it too. Like it was such a great pass that I ended up rewinding it. And Wes Matthews is there, who's probably Dallas's best defender. And, you know, he's a very active defender, and he had his arms down because you just don't imagine anybody making a pass from the angle that he was at on that play. But Jokic just does things like that. It's honestly so fun to watch. But to your point about both the Nuggets and what they're going to be with Millsap. I think they were starting to sort of figure it out and get like a bit of a high-low game going. I think their problem was kind of like pick and rolls didn't really work with them at Millsap, with Millsap at the four, because you could just, I mean, most teams can just switch that and not really have to worry about it too much. But they were sort of starting to find a rhythm, I thought. And it was kind of, I mean, it sucks that he went out, and I'm looking forward to watching them when he comes back, and especially because of the defense, because that's kind of the thing with the Nuggets. I mean, they're a fun watch, but defensively in the playoffs, there's just no way that team's going to hold up. They have too many weak guys, and as much as I love Jokic, he's just the easiest guy to isolate and put on an island. And the way that they're switching them nowadays, like, I have some questions about what Michael Malone is doing for sure. So, I mean, I'm excited to see what they're going to be, but, you know, I don't really have too much confidence in them this year as more than a first round out because of their defense.
Next year could be really fun for them, just if they have that offseason and time to figure this out, because they have a lot of talent and the rest of the team is figuring out. I mean, Gary Harris already got this way last year, and Will Barton has gotten there too, of how to play with Jokic. And I think they're doing a better job this year of playing without him too. And they're just kind of getting into places. Some of that being Jamal Murray being a little bit better has really helped them. And so you think about like kind of reaching the critical mass of talent. I don't know exactly how they're going to manage their salaries, which is unfortunate just because they have a lot of money tied up in players that aren't necessarily helping their team win right now. But I'm excited about that. And so when you look at this and they're like the teams that are coming up and a lot of new playoff teams probably this year, and the fact that most of those should be better next year than they are this year, the Thunder are kind of the awkward one there because we don't know what Paul George is going to do. But Paul George, it sounds to me like he's going to be in the Western Conference on a playoff team either way, whether it's them or whether it's the Lakers, probably. Like the Lakers, if they add Paul George, I think they're a playoff team, and they're probably adding somebody else too. So you have all that going on. And then the other kind of underrated part of it, and there's a reason for this, but the fact that Toronto has been as great as they have been for most of this season, and DeRozan's having his best season, their bench play has been so much better. I think that it gets somewhat undercounted for the same problem that some people have of like, oh, well, if the Warriors are the favorites to win the championship, it's not that interesting. Well, Toronto is a story, whether or not you think they're going to win the Eastern Conference, because they've unlocked something that they didn't have before with largely similar personnel.
Yeah, I think the thing I've been saying about Toronto all season is, well, not all season, but ever since they really kicked things into gear, is that to delegitimize what they're doing and say, let's wait until they do it in the playoffs, I think if you say that about every team and that's kind of just your philosophy, I think that's fair. But I think if you're singling out Toronto, I think that's just superstition. Like, I think it's kind of just like saying they're cursed or something, because this, when you go back and look at Toronto's playoff failures in the past, you could go back into the regular season and kind of track a straight line between it. They didn't pass the ball very well. They were too reliant on two guys, on their two stars, DeRozan and Lowry, and those guys were playing heavy minutes, especially Lowry's, like, considering his age and how much wear and tear he gets over the year. Like, he's one of those guys that, you know, when he's on the floor, he's playing both ends, and there's really no breaks for him. He's a very intense player when he's on the court, so it's all the more reason that he shouldn't be on it for a very long time when you have playoff hopes. So I think, like, there was precedence for, you know, assuming that they were going to not be good in the playoffs. But now you're looking at a team that has really, really reduced the minutes load on the stars because of, like you said, that bench that they have. And, you know, they are passing the ball like they've never passed it before. They have become incredibly tough to guard. I think probably Philly is the team that I saw kind of guard them the best. And some ways that was because Lowry was coming back from an injury and he was pretty rusty, but they were actually, like, you know, teams are starting to catch up to it. They're guarding for the pass and they're really long and athletic, so they could kind of get in Toronto's way. And, you know, Toronto was super off that game too, even for the shots that were open. But, you know, not to delve too much into one game, but I haven't really seen too many teams really be able to figure out Toronto's offense in the regular season. And in the past, it used to be that Toronto was actually the number one, like, comeback team in the NBA. They'd always like get into these big deficits and then come back later. And I think a large part of that can be credited to the fact that at some point DeMar and Lowry would turn it on. We're just not seeing any of that this season. I understand that it's the same personnel, and, you know, I don't want to sound like too much of a homer, but this team is it's different. It's not like the teams of the past.
And I mean, you see it. The easiest counter to the people who are like, oh, let's do it before, is just watch them play. I mean, they look like a different team out there, and the way that the support pieces make more sense now, they are starting Valanciunas, but he is generally not finishing games, which has been true in the past as well, but they understand now what works well for them, and they do still need some more pieces. I mean, I understand why Patrick Patterson isn't there anymore, but they do need that guy who can play the other forward spot if they're sliding Ibaka to center. But they have a lot that's really good there. They're deep. And the way that Casey has been able to, especially when they're at full strength, manage their rotation by making sure the best players are on the floor, the Van Vliet minutes with another point guard, I think, have generally been pretty good, partially because Van Vliet can shoot, he can play off ball, he can play on ball. And some of that gets dissipated a little bit because depth is more valuable in the regular season than the playoffs, unless it's like your top 6, 7, 8 guys. But still, we're seeing a different Raptors team, and the defense to me has been better. And so, yeah, I think there are reasons to be supportive of it. And that doesn't necessarily mean, like, I think they definitely have a better shot at beating Cleveland than they did last year, or than they did 2 years ago, assuming health. But they're a better team. They're a different team. And so I'm not going to hold that all the way against them. It's in the back of your mind. It's always, I mean, you can't take it away, but we shouldn't discount what they're doing because of that.
Right. And you bring up an interesting point. And the one reason people should have questions is the rotation. Obviously, this isn't going to be the same rotation that they'll have in the playoffs. I think the answer to that forward sliding into the Patterson spot, even though, you know, maybe you give up some defensively, but you can move OG Anunoby to the four and have CJ Miles start at the three. And then I don't really think you're giving much up, or, you know, if you need the defensive matchup, then you have Norm. So I don't think they have too much of a problem sliding that forward in. It's just a matter of, we haven't really seen CJ Miles play too much, so we don't really think of him as that guy, but I think he very well could be that guy. And the other big problem is that lineup that they're starting with right now is probably not going to be the lineup that they're going with in the playoffs. So I think there are definitely some fair questions there. But I mean, like we've seen in the past, that lineup is really good. Like when the Raptors play small, they are destructive on both ends. And now the way they're able to switch when they play small is just super impressive. It adds another layer of into the team that, again, like we said, that wasn't there last season. So, you know, I think as much as that stuff definitely does raise questions, especially against a team like Cleveland or Boston, I think mostly, I don't know, I kind of go back and forth on who I think is the most dangerous out of them, just because, I mean, when you watch Cleveland in the regular season, it's kind of like one of those things where, as much as you know not to trust what you're seeing, it's, you watch it over and over again, you kind of start to, right?
I've been able to, with Cleveland, just be able to separate out what is relevant and what isn't, just through experience at this point, because we've been through this so many times. And so, you know, the idea that the effort, and having Wade on this team exacerbates it even more, because Wade's defensive effort is so dramatic in terms of a shift. We saw that last year, even with Chicago, where when he acted like he cared, he went up there. Something I was thinking about as you brought up the CJ Miles thing, which I agree with you that that's probably the answer to how they play in crunch time, is that there is not a team right now, with the way that Cleveland has changed the rotation now that Kevin Love is primarily playing center and they're using Crowder and LeBron at those positions, there isn't a team that plays another guy at the four, you know, so like at those kind of the 3-4-5, there isn't a team that has three guys there that all make you work and freak out, especially through physical strength. Like, they don't have a Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan combination or anything like that, because Boston, they're largely playing with either Aaron Baines, Tatum is having a wonderful year, but that's not the type of strength he is. He's a different type of good player. And so that's them. Miami, they're always going to be playing one guy that's not freaking you out. Milwaukee's going to be playing one guy that doesn't freak you out. So that limitation that CJ Miles brings to that isn't as big of a deal, because you could just put him on the other guy. You have OG on the best kind of forward threat. You put Serge Ibaka at the five, and then you put CJ Miles on the other guy, and you're not going to get killed that way.
Yeah, and I mean, if you need even more defensive cover, then you switch Serge in for Pascal Siakam, who can really, I mean, nobody does a great job on Giannis, but, you know, he's kind of the prototype to do things like that. So, and then you can, I know he can't shoot, but if you only have one player in your lineup that can't shoot, that's not such a bad thing.
Agreed. And again, like, even if you want to go a little further down, like, yeah,
And again, he's another guy, sorry, that gives them a lot more switchability than Serge does. As much as he can switch onto certain matchups, he gets into a lot of trouble. And then you kind of get into a situation where then if you have him on the floor, DeMar is pretty much the only guy that you don't really want switching. And if he's switching between two and three or even like certain ones, it's not too big of a deal. You just don't want him in those like big, small pick and rolls. And, you know, astonishingly, it's kind of okay to have Kyle on those guys. Like he's got a very strong base and, you know, he always fights and obviously you don't want that happening consistently. But in these spot times that you accidentally switch Kyle onto a bigger guy, like it's almost in a sense like there are times when you're just playing chess because every big guy thinks that they can take, like, Kyle's probably like generously listed at 6 feet tall, and then, you know, they don't really end up scoring very often.
Yeah, I mean the concern is also in terms of rim protection, so help defense, rim protection. So if Serge Ibaka is the guy to be that, that's certainly there, but Siakam isn't certainly as capable there. And then if you're getting Ibaka out on the interior, like basically the idea is how much dribble penetration can you prevent? Because if you can prevent it, then it's not really that big a deal. And switching can help with that, of course, all that kind of stuff. So I don't think the Raptors should be freaking out about that. There might be certain moments where you want to go into other alignments. I mean, you could even use Siakam in place of CJ Miles. That's another option just to get more defensively. Or Norm Powell, like just different things. I mean, I think you want Miles' floor spacing. I think that the benefits there are worth it. And something that's different about the East this year is I think the top eight is just stronger, especially 5 through 8 is stronger than in prior years. But all of those teams have weaknesses. So who faces each other is going to really matter. Like I think this year more than any recently, it's not just about, you know, getting the best seed possible. It's going to be about seeding and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I have a question for you. Who do you want most to fall out of the playoffs so that Philly can get in?
So, I mean, I would say that the teams that, you know, so the top three are the top three. They're getting in whether you want to or not, but of course you do. So then Miami, Milwaukee, Philly, Washington, I think those teams are all really interesting. So then basically to me, then the choice that you're making is between the Pacers and the Pistons. And both those teams have some merit. I think the Pistons at full strength are a fascinating team that has played a lot of the good teams very well. They beat Boston already this year. They've played Cleveland tough for years. And I don't remember anecdotally how they've done against the Raptors. But the problem with the Pistons is just that the long game with them is really different. You know, it's just Avery Bradley is going to be a free agent. So I think they're going to bring him back, but going through all that. And the Pacers, you know, they're young and interesting. So I think the Pistons would give those teams a better series, but I'm more interested in what the Pacers are and what the Pacers will be. So I'll say the Pistons out, but both of those would be plenty of fun.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would end up going with the Pistons too. Even though, I mean, the one interesting thing that Drummond really poses is that, like, he will force teams to play bigger, and most of the teams in the East, their best lineups are small. I think almost every team in the East, their best lineups are small. So that could be really interesting. And I was thinking about that. But other than that, like, I think I would rather see Indiana. And I think Victor Oladipo is just so fun. Seeing him in the playoffs would be great. And I think they have a lot more upside and just a lot more of an exciting story. But, and you know, that said, like, I really, really want Philly to get in for the same reasons too. And playoff Embiid, if he can, I mean, I don't know, is he going to be sitting out playoff games? Like, we'll see. But this is true.
There are no back-to-backs in the playoffs, so that does go in their favor. And with the Sixers, one of the reasons why they're at a different level, also because they're really young, is because they are one of the only teams in the bottom part of the picture, because it doesn't look like they're going to get a top four seed. I mean, they would have to be going insane for the rest of the year to do it, is that they have a guy who could potentially be the best player on the floor, not against the Cavs, but against a lot of their teams. Like Embiid he could be a defensive player of the year if he can ever be on the court long enough. I mean, I haven't thought about yet where he's going to be there for me moving forward. They have that with him. Simmons is still figuring it out. I mean, he was great at the beginning of the year, hit a rough patch. That's not really a surprise. But having that guy is crazy. Like, I was talking about it a little bit with Tim Bontemps the other day, and it was like, Embiid is not the all-around player that Kyrie Irving is, or that Al Horford is even at this point. it would not be outside of the realm of realistic possibility for Embiid to be the best player on a 7-game basis for a theoretical Sixers-Celtics series. Like, that's possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's possible. And that is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I go back and forth with people about. Like, I kind of just pose it, so I'll do it here too. Like, if you were, and my answer is Embiid, and I don't know if that's controversial how people would feel about this, but if Embiid did not have his injury history and was like a generally healthy player, I think I would take him over Giannis.
It's tough. I think I would take Giannis because he has the ball in his hands more, and that's just so important. But you can build a great team around Embiid incredibly easily because he's a five that can be a game changer defensively, can stretch the floor a little bit. I think that he's a little bit more confident right now in that shot than it actually goes in. But it's a closer call than I think some would admit. But of course, you have the caveat of like if healthy is just so big for them, just like it is for the Clippers. But yeah, it's an interesting.
Right. Just more like in an imaginary hypothetical world, right? Like where.
Well, and the other idea with, so Giannis is spectacular and I wouldn't say he's an MVP. He's in that realm where it's like he'll get votes for MVP, but he's probably not going to win the award. So I've never been good at figuring out how to talk about that. But with Embiid, you can put really good players of basically any variety next to him because even though he's not the greatest shooter in the world, he's a very good shooter for his position. And that's a big difference there. So like, as long as you get guys that can play, you can make stuff around him. And that's what the idea of with Simmons and Covington that was so intriguing was, it looks like those are two guys that can play and why they've been so great when Redick's been able to be on the floor, because Redick is of course in that conversation as well. So you can do that with them in a very different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it gives, like, let's say for example that Ben Simmons was on Milwaukee, right? Like that would just be so much of a tougher fit. Not like obviously because him and Giannis would need the ball in their hands a lot, but because Giannis can't spread the floor, it would just be, you know, it'd be ugly. And I think the way that Embiid opens the floor up for other players, I mean, when you pair that with a guy like what Ben Simmons could be or another star, like I think the potential there is just huge if he's healthy.
Yeah. Certainly. And Milwaukee is the other kind of the similar kind of elephant in the room, just because they gave Toronto a tough series last year. I thought they played well overall, and Giannis is miles better than he was. Thon Maker has not been nearly as good as he was in that series. And so where do they fit in? Who do they play against? Where is this going to go? And then they also, I mean, we talked about a little bit with the top teams getting guys back, but Jabari is huge for them because not only is he a very good player, but they've been dealing with forward depth and shot creation on the second unit and all these kind of things. And so depending on how Jason Kidd wants to use him, he can make them better. We don't know exactly when he's coming back, but just getting another capable player is going to be useful for them. And
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it gives... Like, let's say, for example, that Ben Simmons was on Milwaukee, right? Like, that would just be so much of a tougher fit. Not, like, obviously because him and Giannis would need the ball in their hands a lot, but because Giannis can't spread the floor, it would just be, you know, it would be ugly. And I think the way that Embiid opens the floor up for other players, I mean, when you pair that with a guy like what Ben Simmons could be or another star, like, I think the potential there is just huge if he's healthy.
So, yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes and where all this movement happens. And then also, just generally speaking, this has been a season where a lot of young or youngish players have been good in the first half of the season. Some have been very good. And so who keeps it up? Who tones it down? And what does that mean? You know, Aaron Gordon was on fire the first month of the season. He's still having a nice year, still having the best year of his career. His former teammate, Victor Oladipo, has taken it to a whole nother level this year. Giannis, we already talked about. And so those kind of guys, who keeps it up, who lets down a little bit, and basically who's for real, because that doesn't necessarily affect whether, like, I don't think Indiana is going to win a playoff series, even if Victor Oladipo plays the way he's playing, but it's relevant for where they are moving forward and how they approach this offseason.
Yeah, I think Oladipo's kind of become the convenient guy to wonder about, and I think it's partially fair, but I think, you know, a lot of that just comes down to, like, the same thing with the Raptors, it's just because we haven't seen it before. I think at this point, it's, I don't know, maybe we aren't long enough, we haven't gone long enough into the season, but the numbers he's putting up are just, I mean, like, they're right on par with Kyrie and DeMar, and the way he's doing, he's just like, he's become a matchup nightmare. Like, there's very, like, even if you put your best defender on him, he is faster than them. And if not, then he's going to end up being bigger than them. And the way that he's run that offense is just like, I just feel like we should be given some sort of reason that regression is coming before there should be speculation about whether it's coming, you know?
You're right. And the conversation should be split into two. And it's the same thing with Jason Tatum, actually, to another guy who is outperforming expectations. And it's separating it into shooting and everything else. So the other elements of Oladipo has been doing, he's looked way more dynamic with the ball in his hands and just making the right passes, creating separation. That stuff isn't going away. But he's shooting almost 42% from three this year. His career high is 36. If all you do is you take that a step back to 36, 37, then he's a way less productive player. And so you want to temper those two things. And so what I've been having challenges with him and with Tatum is, let's say that's what happens. Let's say all of the other creation, I mean, Tatum has been better. His handle is way sharper than I thought it was going to be at this stage. He's not settling in the same way. Stevens deserves credit for that. So, okay, let's say that everything else stays the same and the shooting goes back to a reasonable level. There's still a really valuable player. I would say in Oladipo's case, in that circumstance, he becomes, instead of being a surefire all-star, maybe like a fringe all-star. You know, like right now, like I have him, I think I had him on an all-NBA team last when Nate and I did our awards last month. He's not in that realm if you drop his three-point shooting a little bit, but he's still a really, really good player. And the same is true with Tatum. So I think that it is fair, and sometimes people see three-point shooting as everything. It certainly is not. And the underlying, like the bones of them as players are looking very good.
Right. Speaking about Tatum's ball handling, did you watch the game against the Pelicans yesterday?
I watched a portion of it, but not the entire thing.
Okay. I think it was in the second quarter. He put Drew Holiday just like...
Oh, the one where he shook him? Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, that was just like, oh my God.
Well, and so, and that kind of ties in. So Tatum, like early on, the stuff about how he idolized Kobe freaked me out, because Kobe, you think of late career Kobe and the guy, because that's kind of part of it, was what Tatum looked like in summer league, was he was very comfortable taking bad shots. And so there are elements of Kobe that are positive, and you know, like he's a dominant scorer and the things that he could do. And then there are elements of old career Kobe that you don't want. And what has been really impressive with Tatum is that he turned the elements in terms of skill development, getting better with the ball in his hands, moving it when he doesn't have something, competing on defense. He's been able to put all those things out there and take away the parts of that that looked more concerning. Like the idea was always, like the concern was that he would be a square peg in a round hole, that he wouldn't be able to do that. And it's not, you know, you don't want to read into 40 something games to say that's the way he is, but we have a really good sample now to say those concerns, it's not that they were poorly founded, because I think they were well founded, because that's the player he had been, but those concerns should be minimized, if not eliminated entirely.
Right. And I think, first of all, I want to say I agree with your point about, you know, separating the percentages and the skill development. I think you put it really well, and that's kind of like the struggle that seems to be happening with a lot of the discussion around these two guys. And yeah, like I think the thing with Tatum is like we're finding it's kind of like you kind of wonder which side of it is. Like, is he like this because he's like this, or is it because he's playing in Brad Stevens' system and you know he's playing alongside another amazing scorer that kind of really that helps him and takes attention off of him. We don't really necessarily know. Like, would he, let's say he was in Donovan Mitchell's position with the Jazz, like maybe there are some of the things that you're getting squeamish about that are actually happening. And you know, it's hard to say, but at the same time, like you just see just the level of ease that he plays with when he's on the court. Like, he plays like a vet, you know. And there aren't too many moments where I feel like, oh, Tatum shouldn't have taken that shot. Like, of course it happens. It happens on occasion. It happens with everybody. But, you know, his ability to just like reset, make the extra pass, or, you know, the amount of times that he goes without touching the ball. I think, in fact, like he should be shooting it a lot more than he is actually. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe it'll take seeing him in a couple of years to see, like, where his actual mentality is with that kind of thing. But right now, it seems like he's kind of hit the perfect balance.
He has, and that is always a risky proposition. The guy that I always think of with this is OJ Mayo. And so OJ Mayo had been the best player on basically every team he had ever played on until he got to the NBA. And it was always, you know, unless he reached like the top 10% of his outcomes, it was going to be the case that he wasn't going to be the best player on his team. And so it didn't seem like he could handle that, you know, that he could get into it. He also didn't develop as much. And you could talk about the work ethic. Darius Miles is another example of this. And so that's why I always worry about those guys. And those worries are not there anymore whatsoever for Jason Tatum. He has fit in so well with what Boston is doing. And yes, they're going to be very different next year or late this year. Who knows? When Gordon Hayward gets back, like they're going to be different mouths to feed. The ball movement is going to be different. It's just that's the way this is when you add in another good player who's good with the ball in his hands. But Tatum has shown, as Jaylen Brown has shown, the ability to embrace that sort of a role. And for Boston to reach their ceiling, whatever that ceiling is, they needed that to happen. And so, yes, they've been way better than a lot of us anticipated when Gordon Hayward went down with an injury. And that is good. The wins and losses are. But those guys having high ceilings, but being willing to embrace smaller roles as warranted by the system is a bigger victory than the wins they have on the ledger right now.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's no questioning that.
And Boston, I mean, I know people get mad at me because I'm critical of certain elements of where this is going. Like, the good thing that they have is they have a lot of assets still, fewer because of what they gave up to get Kyrie, and Kyrie's looking great, so you can talk about how that's worth it. Mm-hmm. But these guys fit in relatively well. So like the idea of if they got AD or whatever else, the idea of getting the next James Harden, whoever that is, you know, like they have a pretty nice asset base to make that happen. But another part of that is that you have to have the surrounding talent that makes sense, or you need to have the openness to get the talent. And that's what Morey did right in Houston, was he had it open enough that once they figured out who Harden was, they could build around it. And so they got Nene as kind of a role player. You know, Eric Gordon is such a wonderful fit for what they're doing. Ryan Anderson, you know, those sorts of things. Like, there are two different ways to do it. And the way it looks like Boston is, if they can make that trade, and who knows if that player is even going to become available, is they have a reasonable belief that the other guys are going to make sense. So that, and that's a good sales pitch, because while they don't have cap space, generally speaking, you can't acquire a player of that caliber without them buying in. And so I'm encouraged by that. We just have to see the opportunity present itself, because with the extension system fixed for elite guys now, it's a different conversation. And like, there's a reason we haven't seen a marquee, you know, MVP potential talent player traded since James Harden, because those trades don't happen very often.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd add to that is, they also, just the way the roster is constructed, there's very few players, like, I really can't even think of one player who wouldn't really fit their system and their personnel, because, I mean, the Celtics are, there's Kyrie Irving, and then there's, the most you could say is, like, another, you don't want to get, like, another combo guard in there or something. So, like, you know, it's Kyrie, it's a bunch of 3-and-D guys, and there's Al Horford, who is one of the most, like, adaptable and smart, high IQ players that there is in the NBA. And kind of like defensively too, he can do some switching, and he really covers the backside well against, you know, let's say they bring in a guy that's not really necessarily like a good defender. I don't really know who that would be, but like he can do it on both sides, and he can kind of like have adaptability there. So it seems like the stage would be set for Boston, kind of like the way that the Warriors were before they got Durant. Not to compare those teams, but just, you know, the way that they were kind of set up to be a team that, you know, they could kind of like take any sort of personnel on.
They can, and it happens that a lot of the best players that are out there, you know, that they would be looking at are in the more forward to center range. Like, they're guys who are 6'6 or taller. So that does tie in well with where it would be. We just have to see if that person comes and who it is, and that's going to take some time. Anything else? Oh, go ahead.
There is actually a new wrinkle in the Rockets-Clippers locker room fiasco.
Okay.
Mark Stein just tweeted that he's hearing strongly that Clint Capella was not the Rocket who appeared at the Clippers locker room doorway Monday night. Belief is now that it was Tariq Black and not in any sort of diversionary tactic.
Okay. You know, there is always the kind of the fog that surrounds these sort of things. It could also be, my instinct as soon as they said the whole, like, Chris Paul wasn't the ringleader was that they didn't want him to get suspended. But it could also be reality. Like, you have to parse all that, and that's why these NBA investigations take so long. But, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting, and it's unfortunate that some of it might tie in with the Rockets-Warriors game on Saturday, though, again, this is too early to read much into that. It's not like if the Rockets or the Warriors win that game, we're going to be making big reads on where that is as a series, but it would have been nice to see.
All right, but it would have been nice to see. And it kind of just goes back to the whole thing that we haven't really been able to see anything this season, so everyone's kind of still laying in wait to an extent. Like, I think the most, at least like playoffs-wise, most interesting game I watched was Celtics versus Warriors this season. Everything else is kind of like, oh, I don't really know what's going on. But back to the logistics of the whole scenario, which I think is really the most important thing here. This actually kind of confirms a theory that I had. My original theory was actually what you said, that hearing that Chris Paul and James Harden weren't involved and that it was mostly a reason they were trying to stop him was kind of just like, I don't know about that. Like, probably they just don't want those guys getting suspended. Maybe this is part of it. And they're like, oh, wait, Capella's really important too. He wasn't there. But if you're going to believe what they had to say, my theory is that Ariza was super mad, and Ariza played for the Lakers, so he knows about the secret tunnel too. So he probably like tried to rush in there, and then Chris Paul, obviously also knowing about this secret tunnel because he played in the Staples Center as well, runs after him. He's like, no. And then, you know, a couple other guys follow just as backup until, like, you know, help out with the situation. And the only thing that was a problem with that theory was that I just had no explanation for the Clint Capella thing, which is, I mean, the most hilarious thing ever. The type of thing that, you know, nobody really could ever have an explanation for other than that they were actually, you know, trying to rush a locker room with five people, which, you know, as tantalizing as that scenario is, probably not true. So this kind of clears things up. Now we just have to know what Tariq Black was doing there.
Yeah, and it also, like, the internal consistency of the player who looked the most frustrated on the court being the player who was initiating that, being Trevor Ariza, makes internal sense.
Right.
And Tariq Black also played for the Lakers, so he also would theoretically know about the back passageways as well. But you could see, just, and this, especially if it wasn't planned, that it could be something like that he was mad and wanted to do something like that. Also, he wasn't involved in the hostility, so it could have even been that his approach was something different, that it could have been maybe that he wanted to just clear the air or something like that. We don't exactly know. But the fortunate thing is that the NBA will get to the bottom of it. And the other fortunate part of it is, it's kind of the silly season at the point when the silly season is appropriate. If this sort of crap is happening in the playoffs, I won't appreciate it. But for right now, this is the part of the year that, other than the trade deadline for cap nerds like me, can be sort of the doldrums. And anything that makes the doldrums more interesting, I'm 100% on board.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was supposed to be kind of like the boring part. And maybe this is happening because it is like kind of the boring part of the season. Everybody's cabin fever, so they're just constantly like getting into fights. I mean, Kyle Lowry and Ben Simmons like had like shared some words on the court, and then you know, they were sweet in another tunnel. And that was like not even part of the coverage because of everything that happened after. So I think everybody's just a little bit bored.
Also, what's called the sex appeal of that is very different than the Lakers and Rockets, who have so many established players and are more famous. But yeah, I mean, the Lowry Simmons thing was definitely interesting, and that could actually be a playoff series. So it could come into play. Of course, Clippers Rockets could be as well. So a lot to look forward to. Anything else that you're going to be really watching for the next, I don't know, few weeks, month, whatever?
No, I mean, I think we covered both the teams in the league, right? So I think we got it.
Yeah, the only other one I'm not going to go into too much depth is Oklahoma City, like just figuring out what they are. I don't think they're going to make any big moves at the deadline, but their ceiling is still crazy high. So where this goes with them, and I'm excited to see it. And now with Kawhi, you know, we don't know exactly what it's going to be with him. The possibility of a Spurs-Thunder first round series is absolutely insane. That would be crazy, because I thought it was going to be Wolves-Thunder for a long time and that the Spurs were going to figure this out, but maybe that's not going to be it. But either way, with those three, if we're going to get two of those three teams in a first round series, that's going to be the best first round series on the board.
Yeah, and even if Kawhi isn't, I mean, let's really, really hope he's back for the playoffs, but, you know, we don't really know what indefinitely means. But even if he isn't back, I mean, we could still really hypothetically see that series being really entertaining. And, you know, it could be just like the gambit of Pop's career. I mean, not, you know, he's had much more important moments in winning a first round series, but, you know, like, what if they win? You know, they could.
They could. It'd be a lot of fun. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Sirit Sohi for taking the time to come on. You can read her at her regular tip-off columns at SB Nation, her Raptors stuff at The Athletic, Toronto, does a great job there. And then when she has the chance to, she writes amazing features. Those can be wherever. I mean, she's done some great stuff for Rolling Stone. She's done some for ESPN, Bleacher, all sorts of other places. And you can also, of course, follow her at Damian Triller, DamianTrillard. Still one of my favorite handles that exists on there. And yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation. It was fun to go in all of those different directions at the same time. And this has been out there a little bit on Twitter. I talked about it on Thursday, where I'm not sure how much this is going to affect your lives, but Real GM Radio is now a part of the Podcast One network. It is very exciting for me because they're a big player in this business, and I'm excited for the opportunity to work with them and see where this goes. And our preliminary conversations and everything have been wonderful. But I also want to thank CLNS Media, who I've been with for most of the time this podcast has run. I think over 2 years. I don't know the exact timing of it. And Nick Gelso and everybody over there does fantastic work. It was just an opportunity that the Real GM brass and I didn't feel that we could pass up. It was hard to leave, but it was there. So one basic question that can be asked is, what does this mean in terms of you, the listener? And the answer is, I don't exactly know yet. I mean, Podcast One has been wonderful and supportive in terms of the content itself. That I expect to be there. The hope is that it can be, you know, that we have enough ads to make it worth my while, to make it worth everyone's while. And the other benefit, for those of you who are like, oh, more ads in it, that's a bad thing. Well, the good thing is, if we get enough of them, then I will be open to doing a second episode, either per week or when permitted. And that's really exciting. There's so much content, as much as some people are like, God, how do you produce so much stuff? There's so much more that I would love to do if the opportunity can present itself and if we can do that. So that is a hope. We'll see where this goes. It might create some cool cross-pollination opportunities, things like that. We're still working through that with Podcast One, but I'm thrilled about the possibility. As always, there are a lot of ways that you can support the show. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing. It's great if it's iTunes, because they're still very, very big for our business. You can also subscribe, download every episode, great things to support. And of course, you can check out our sponsors for this episode. That is Simple Contacts. SimpleContacts.com/RealGM, or the RealGM promo code gets you $30 off your first order, which is fantastic. And their vision test is only $20. You can do it in less than 5 minutes, gets checked by a doctor. You can do it over your phone or on the computer. I wish it had been around when I did my last vision check, because that's fantastic. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, you can always reach out, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com. That's the far superior way, but at DannyLarue on Twitter if you really, really want to. And yeah, I mean, it's fun to be really back in the saddle doing this show, doing everything else, because it's a fun time. I mean, we're trying to really figure out where everything is going. And this podcast is a great way to talk with intelligent people and have some of the clarifying conversations. And that's was always part of the idea of doing the show. And it's something that I hope to continue in this new-ish iteration of it. And I'm so excited to be with Podcast One. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make a great day.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.